Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Glad you're tuned in this morning. On these first Mondays of the month, we're going to focus on the science of health and medicine. And today we're investigating the science of aging, especially deep aging. There are an estimated 90,000 plus Americans who are 100 years old or older. Yes, that's a small fraction of our population, but it is growing. In fact, the CDC says this group has expanded by 44% just in the last 20 years, and the majority are women. So we're interested in what scientists are learning about centenarians. Is it good medical care? Is it a robust group of family and friends? Is it great genes? Here's one hint. The New England Centenarian study recently found that there are 281 genetic markers that are strongly influential in predicting who will live to 100. Dr. Thomas Pearls is with us, a professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine and director of the New England Centenarian Study. With us today from Beverly, Massachusetts, Dr. Pearls, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Dr. Claudia Kawas is with us, a neurologist and the lead investigator of the 90-plus study at UC Irvine. And with us today from Laguna Beach, California, Dr. Kawas, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Kawas, I want you to check a fact that I thought I read. Half the babies born today will live to their 100th birthday, have a very good chance of living to 100. Give me the facts on that, because that is startling.
Everyone seems startled by that. And it's not my quote, actually. It's a quote from Dr. Christensen, and was published a few years ago in Projections of how the number of elderly throughout the world, actually, are really growing. We're the fastest growing segment of the population. And actually, right now, if things continue and we get beyond COVID, we can expect that the majority of children born in the United States and Europe, for example, will live to be about 103 or beyond.
Wow. I got a tweet here before the show, and it seems like something that would be good to tackle. Nick says, be sure to point out the distinction between life expectancy and lifespan, and that much of the improvement is because we're no longer expected to die as children from one of many preventable illnesses. Is he right? And what should we understand about it?
Thank you for saying that.
Okay, tell us.
Everyone jumps on me when they saw me say that before. And I think it's really important to point out the difference between life expectancy and average life expectancy. I mean, right now, life expectancy, for example, in the United States is only about 78 or 9. And yet many people live not only into their 80s, but 90s and even past 100. So when I say that half of all children can be expected to live to 103, that's not saying that life expectancy is 103,
right,
but that we are fulfilling more of our lifespan.
All right. Dr. Pearls, I want to come back to genetics and something that your study at the New England Centenarian Study found when you examined this sweeping amount of research. I found this startling. People who live to 100 or beyond have just as many genetic variants for risks to their hearts and brains and cellular deterioration. I mean, I think the reason this is startling to me is because I guess I assumed that if you get to this age or you're on your way to this age, you are somehow impervious to those risks. But this would seem to not be the case. Will you explain more of this?
Of course. And I have to say hi to Claudia. It's great to hear you on this on this show, Claudia. So the thing about getting to 100 and older is that we have found that the component of that is explained by genetics increases with older and older ages as people become more and more rare. So as you said, about 1 out of 5,000 individuals gets to be 100. But these numbers drop way off very quickly. So by the time you get to, say, 105, it's about 1 out of 250,000. By the time you get to 110, it's 1 out of 5 million. And with that rarity, we're finding that genetics plays an increasingly greater and greater role in people getting to those ages. And then the question is, what kind of genes are important here? And aging is an incredibly complicated thing with many different mechanisms, biological mechanisms that are involved, both mechanisms that that make people age faster, for example, as well as mechanisms to protect from the processes that lead to aging, mechanisms like DNA repair and fighting free radicals and things like that.
Interesting.
Now, there is this idea that the centenarians have as many of the genetic variants that are associated with aging-related diseases, things that predispose you to these diseases, as the rest of the population. So what they likely have is other genetic variants that are protective, things that protect against those deleterious variants, as well as do things like slow down aging and decrease your risk for aging-related diseases.
And just as I think, Dr. Pearls, you suggested about the complexity of aging, just as you might have, you know, a number of variants, does it sound like it is a combination of these protectant variants, too, that might mean that you don't, what, experience the, I get what, deterioration that maybe these risks for heart disease and cancer and cell deterioration would create in others?
That's right. So the fact that there are so many mechanisms involved, biological mechanisms, speaks to the fact that there are many different genes that are involved in those mechanisms, that regulate those mechanisms and so on. And so it's not just one gene. Any single gene has a very minor, mild effect, but it's the combination, getting the right combination. It's like winning the lottery. Getting one or two numbers is not a big deal. Getting all seven numbers, that's a really big deal.
That's
and getting
a good
the right combination of those variants is what gets people to say 105 or even 110. We found that these genetic signatures get very accurate in terms of predicting who's going to get to 110 or not, because it really is such a rare phenomenon.
All right.
The signatures are much less accurate for, say, people getting to 100, a much more common phenomenon.
Let's take some calls. And if you've just gotten in on the show, it's a conversation. I was really excited about this. I've been reading a lot of the science on aging. And we have two guests this morning who are right at the research frontier on this. I'm excited about this. Dr. Claudia Kawas is with us. She's the lead investigator of the 90-plus study at UC Irvine. And Dr. Thomas Pearls is with us. He's the director of the New England Centenarian Study. And it's a conversation about deep aging, what it is, what the science is revealing about how some people age into their late 90s and beyond. To Nancy in Bemidji. Hi, Nancy. Glad you called.
Yes. Thank you for airing this topic, especially as we've heard that the longevity people will go down with the recent, you know, pandemic by a year. Our mother did live till 100 and a half. She was very Norwegian, daughter of immigrants who moved over here. She was able to live in her home up until the last month of her life.
Oh, my gosh,
she did have open-heart surgery at age 86, and she realized she probably needed a little work done as she was loading firewood into the wheelbarrow because she still cooked on a wood stove.
Oh, my gosh. Wow, Nancy.
Yeah, and the doctor did say she had the heart of a 65-year-old, so they felt that it was good to go ahead and give her surgery. And she lived, you know, another 15 years. She was our tour guide and translator at age 91 and going back to Norway. So yeah. I'm really curious as to see the role of genetics, you know, speaks for our family, as well as how much does hard work enter into this, you know, a simple diet, she ate oatmeal every morning, and what are the resiliency factors? Because she did grow up in deep poverty, had adverse childhood experiences, and yet still was able to live a very productive life and still be an active reader and writer.
We could
Thank
probably
you.
Do the rest of the show just on those questions, Dr. Kawas, but how do you want to tackle them?
Oh, well, we have a saying, and I think you just heard a great example of it. Choose your parents well. So congratulations to your mom and also to you, because obviously you're carrying a lot of the genes that Dr. Pearl has just mentioned and may win some lotteries. I think all of what we talk about always has to do with both genetics and environment, and the stress that your mom had might have actually served to make her strongly as likely as it was to do anything else.
Yeah, Dr. Kawas, she are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, good,
yeah.
Good. She was also asking about personal habits and, you know, an active lifestyle and how much, and I guess family and friend interaction and how much that contributes to, you know, what you inherit, as you're both saying, whether you win the gene lottery. How do you separate that as you're doing this research?
Well, we look at all these things as much as we can. And when people ask me how to live past 100, I tell them the best answer I have is to do what your mother told you. And the reason for this is because we've looked, in regards to longevity, a lot of lifestyle factors. We initially thought vitamins, for example, vitamin E, vitamin C, vitamin A, intake might be related to longevity, and at least in the 90-plus study, it was not. We looked at all kinds of things, but what we found was the following. Unfortunately, for a couch potato like me, exercise matters. So doing that wood carrying to the stove was actually a great thing. Even 15 minutes a day of exercise is associated with greater longevity than if you don't do it. And 30 minutes is better. And 45 minutes is the best, fortunately. More than that doesn't seem to matter so much. And social engagement and non-exercise activities was the other thing that mattered the most.
Huh.
So individuals up to 8 hours a day who in their 70s were doing things with other people, things that use their mind, those kinds of things were all put together, and the more you did, the longer you lived. The other things that we found had to do possibly with social engagement also, because caffeine intake in moderation and alcohol intake in moderation is also associated with greater longevity. And while everyone likes to hear that, I think the more important thing to remember is it might not be the caffeine and the alcohol. It might be the way we consume caffeine and alcohol.
Right. With other people, right? In kind of a social setting. Right. Dr. Kawas, just one more thing on that. I think I saw in your research that putting on a few pounds as you age is an okay thing.
No, it's better than okay. It's probably good.
Really? Why?
About 30 years ago, one of my colleagues at the National Institute of Health said that the best mortality experience was gaining about 5 to 10 pounds a decade after the age of 65. Hmm. And in fact, even in studies done in large numbers of people with the CDC, for example, individuals who are overweight in their 80s and 90s actually live as long, if not longer, than individuals who are normal weight. And both of them do very, very well compared to underweight. It's very bad to be thin when you get to 90 and 100.
All right. Something to aspire to here. Pete says, my maternal grandmother lived past 100. So did one of my grandmothers on my mom's side. My mother is in her late 80s, and other than some sore knees, she's in great shape. Crazy good genes. To Pete in Minnetonka. Hi, Pete. Thanks so much for waiting.
You bet. Good morning.
Morning.
Interesting topic. So
thanks.
I would like to hear your guest touch on the arena of genetics versus epigenetics, as I think that's been a kind of a co-tied topic to this discussion, right? Around, even though you inherit maybe some poor genetic traits that, you know, whether it's heart disease or risk of cancer, et cetera, that you can offset that certainly from an epigenetic standpoint in terms of lifestyle choices, right, in terms of diet, et cetera.
And maybe like the reverse, yeah.
Right. I mean, and actually, she just touched on the interesting topic of, you know, the alcohol intake. It's like, well, wouldn't it offset if social interaction is good for you and you're drinking with friends, don't those offset? I would think that they would, but
yeah.
I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, but so the Codebreaker book, I think that ties in here. I don't know if you know that, right? The Jennifer Duda, she won the,
right.
won the Nobel Peace Prize. And I think that's a very interesting tie-in to what you're discussing today. So not to get too carried away here, but I would just like to hear the epigenetic versus genetic
okay.
kind of
Dr. Pearls, will you tackle that? And then I have a follow-up question to that.
Sure. So epigenetics has to do with the interaction between environment and genes. And Claudia, who I would say is one of the world's experts on resilience, spoke to a lot of the factors that are we would call environmental, that interact with our genes and make us who we are and how we're aging and so on. So there are factors, as Claudia indicated, that have been associated with longevity. We have individuals who've gotten beyond the age of 100 who still do pretty bad things to themselves. Maybe smoking is very, very unusual, but we've had a few people who've had a history of smoking
wow.
or drinking too much. We have guys who boast that they're drinking a couple of gin and tonics a day and smoking a cigar. And my answer to that is they must have spectacular genes in terms of the protective genes that I mentioned that are making them. If they stop those habits, they might even be able to live even longer.
Wow.
I think Claudia's already mentioned many of the factors that have been linked to longevity. The issue with the weight, I think, is remember, as you said at the outset of this show, that the vast majority of centenarians are women. I would say about 80-85%.
Mm-hmm.
And women are more predisposed to osteoporosis and fracture. And having more weight has been associated with decreased risk for osteoporosis.
Wow.
And I think that's the main mechanism going on there. And men are different from women when it comes to the factors that are conducive to extreme old age. And I think for my part, it's been pretty hard to find an overweight male centenarian. They tend to either be thin or certainly within the normal range of weight.
Dr. Kawas, to get back to some of the effect of stress and toxic stress and how that may carry on down through generations. I mean, we know that the lifespan of Americans of color is often shorter than white Americans. And I wonder if in looking into the research on this, whether this effect of sustained stress may account for the way their cells age and may account for the way the generations that follow, how they age?
Well, it certainly can. I mean, stress, I've said for years, is important, and I'd study it more if I knew how to measure it. But I think that to say it's only due to stress would be to oversimplify it, because healthcare disparities of all sorts and a lot of are really related to longevity, and we really have a healthcare disparity problem throughout the world, and especially in the United States, that probably contributes to that. I wanted to comment a bit about the genetic environment interaction, because I think a really good example of what we've been talking about, to our knowledge, the oldest documented person in the world was Jean-Louis Calment, who was born in Arles, France, and sold paintbrushes to Vincent van Gogh as a child. And she lived to be 122.
Oh, my gosh.
Truly extraordinary. But Jean-Louis left no DNA on this planet because her daughter died in her 30s. And then she raised her grandson, who also died at a relatively young age in a traumatic accident. And so the genes aren't everything. Other things matter, and your lifestyle and the epigenetic changes that happen are definitely related.
Dr. Pearls, just a quick question about that. Are you able to, I was reading this research that said that you can find these variants for, in this study, extreme survival on specific chromosomes, and that you could isolate those variants to see that they protected against cardio disease and Alzheimer's. I wondered if you can get that specific and if you know where to look to find these protective variants.
There are specific genes and there are variations that have been linked to exceptional longevity. And I would say, and you know, we did find these 210 markers that point to about 130 genes. There's some very, very well-known genes that relate to Alzheimer's disease, and having one variant decreases your risk, and having a different variant increases your risk. Still a pretty minor part of the population, though, but we do know some variants. And the main reason we look for these variants is to try and understand what mechanisms are involved. These are our signposts for these mechanisms. And once we know the mechanisms, maybe we can start even developing medications that might help protect people for these age-related diseases like Alzheimer's. But the other thing I want to get to that I bet you people are wondering is, well, why can't I find out about some of those variations and know my own risk of getting to extreme old age? And I think you definitely do not need that. What you need is to look at the family history. If you, like the one caller who had a mom who lived to over 100 and a mom's sister who lived to over 100, you're at markedly increased chances yourself of getting to these very old ages. So all you have to do really is look at your pedigree. I have a life expectancy calculator that's free on the web. It's been there a long time. A lot of colleges and high schools use it for their health classes at livingto100.com.
Okay.
And livingto100.com. And there's a question in there that asks about the longevity in your family for just this reason. I'll also say that only about half of our centenarians give a history of longevity in their families. And I think that's in part because particularly earlier than the 1960s, people were dying of all kinds of things that are now either curable or greatly delayed with good health care.
I see. And
they didn't know if a person who could have lived to 100 but didn't because they died of a pneumonia or something that could have responded to surgery. There will be about half of centenarians who don't have any longevity in their families, and that's where you don't know if there's a predisposition or not.
So, Dr. Kawas, does that mean that your family history today, with the kind of medical advances, will end up being much more important to the people that someday take over the studies that you both are leading than it was looking into the past for the centenarians today. Is that what that says?
Well, I think so. You know, in the early 1900s, life expectancy overall was only 48 or 49. So what we've done in the last century in terms of extending life expectancy has been astonishing. And I think it's a tribute to medicine and healthcare that we've been able to do that. But the genes you bring to the table are going to matter more and more as we have other, and as Tom pointed out, it'll give us ideas of where to look to try to further deal with the problems that often keep us from reaching 100. And also, even more importantly, I think we want to not just reach 100, we want to reach 100 in good shape.
Right.
When we see 95-year-olds zipping around in convertibles and power walking and everything, I mean, that's what we hope for all of us, not 95-year-olds who can't recognize family or need a lot of care and can't walk.
Just want to grab a call here from Rebecca on our way to getting the latest news. Hi, Rebecca. Sounds like you're on your way to see your grandparents. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I was really happy to hear your show about longevity because I've wondered, along with the rest of my family, how my grandparents, who have been married for 78 years,
oh my gosh,
my grandmother just turned 100, and my grandfather, if he makes it, will be 105 next month.
Wow.
So,
oh my gosh.
And his father lived to be 104. So I know we attribute it to genes, but one other thing I would mention is I think it's because they're together that they've both made it this far, because they're just they've been together for so long, and it's just a kind of a wonderful thing to see.
No.
And he also is a World War II vet. So when I heard you speaking about the stress and how for some people, you know, that makes it harder for them to live as long, I'm just wondering at how, what he saw in World War II and how stressful that was for him, he still managed to live such a long life after that.
Right. Have a wonderful visit with your grandparents. It's
Thanks
really
so
inspiring
much.
To hear about them and this long marriage. Conversation, if you're just getting in on it, on what two top researchers, one from the New England Centenarian Study, that's Dr. Thomas Pearls, and Dr. Claudia Kawas from the 90-plus study at UC Irvine, California, what they are learning about the people who are living into deep old age, well, and beyond, past 100, in Forest Lake. Hi, Denny. Thanks for waiting through the newscast. What are you interested in?
Well, I read about a study recently where the guy who discovered this got a Nobel Prize, but he found out that our cells can only reproduce about 50 times. After that, they start decaying and become what they call zombie cells. And as those cells decay, they have a negative effect on the surrounding cells. And the researchers are believing that is one of the effects of aging. And there is a company, I've read about their study, but I haven't found the name of the company yet, but this company has found a way to remove the zombie cells. And when that happens, research with animals has shown that the animals start aging in reverse, and older animals are just as active and alive and everything as animals that are much younger.
Okay, let's ask Denny if we might. Can we ask Dr. Pearls about this idea of aging cells and zombie cells and their effect on aging? Dr. Pearls?
Sure. Thanks for the question. Scientific circles, they're called senolytic cells, and you're absolutely right that there's been quite a bit of research, exciting research, in which certain drugs can be given to remove these cells that produce all kinds of toxic substances inflammatory substances especially that seem to accelerate the aging process. And by removing those cells, much of these substances are decreased as well. And there, as you can imagine, a number of companies, as well as most importantly, academic centers, particularly Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, is at the forefront of this research. Some of the drugs that have been tried so far have all kinds of side effects and what have you. So I would say we're still pretty early in the research, but it's really promising and could be really important. I would say not so much around aging as some of the aging-related diseases. And as Claudia had indicated, the point is not to get a lot of people to 100, but to get a lot of people to age very well. And hopefully that means getting at least into your 90s in really good shape. But that's where this research seems to be heading. And I would say maybe within about 10 years, we might actually see some drugs that are working the way we're talking. Yep.
Dr. Kawas, I wanted to ask you about research out of the University of California. Maybe Professor Saul Vieda is a colleague of yours? I didn't know if this was being done at Irvine.
No, it's not. But
let me describe this. He is working on research that shows that infusing older mice with the blood of young mice improves cognitive decline in the old mice. And he talked about this enzyme called TET2 that's associated with memory and learning.
Exactly. And I think it's a version of what the previous caller was asking about is, and first I need to preface this with, there's a lot of things we can do in animals that don't necessarily immediately translate to humans. So we need to be very cautious because we can do things, for example, like there are more than 100 compounds that have been found to prevent, delay, or treat in other ways. For example, our animal models of Alzheimer's disease, but at least so far, none of them have translated directly to being useful in humans. But this is an exciting idea, that the idea that young cells are different, they make different things, they can put different things in the body, and if we give young cells to older animals under the right conditions, we can make those cells look healthier, at least for a period of time. I think that's the kind of research that's going to, in 10 years, as Tom says, potentially get us to being able to do something like this. But at least at the moment, it's not ready for humans, I would say. And as exciting as it is, it'll take a little bit more work to get there.
Yeah. I don't know that we've ever gotten a call before from a centenarian, but thanks to you, Dr. Pearls and Dr. Kawas, we have one on the phone to Carol in the Twin Cities. Carol, how old are you?
On the 25th of this month, I will be 106.
Oh my gosh. Congratulations and happy birthday. And
well,
what?
Well, thank you. I shall have, I know. And I'm still living alone.
Oh my gosh. Carol, what do you attribute such a long, healthy, independent life to?
Facetiously, I always said good, clean living. But I my father lived to be almost 99, and I have taken care of myself. I ate well. I walked a lot up until I was about 98. I was walking up to 3-4 miles a day with Nordic poles.
Wow.
So I say it's a combination. And I live in a wonderful building, a condo building. It's a high rise, and I have great, great neighbors. So I have always been able to be with people.
Carol, I think Dr. Kawas is going to say you've hit on three of the very important elements that we've been talking about this morning. Dr. Kawas, is that right? Do you hear that?
Absolutely. And Carol, congratulations. What I would say is that Carol knows all the secrets of aging, and she's going to have to join one of our studies so that we can learn even more from her.
Carol, Dr. Kawas is trying to recruit you. What were you going to add?
Oh, a glass of red wine every night.
Ah, yes. All right. Carol, have you been in any of the research studies, maybe at Mayo or?
I was in one at the Veterans.
Okay. All right.
And I just got lazy.
Have the happiest of birthdays, Carol. Thank
I
you.
Shall.
I'm so glad you heard the show or someone called to say, hey, you should call in. It's wonderful to have you on. Thank you. Dr. Pearls, what would you add to Carol's experience here?
I don't know. I'm just smiling from ear to ear hearing
106.
Her. 106.
Living independently.
It is amazing. And the story that she gives as to what her secret is incredibly is a common refrain among our centenarians. I'd say the other one is that folks like to say that it's God's will. A number of our centenarians are pretty religious, and I think that plays an important role in their lives as well. And, of course, the fact that her dad lived to 99 speaks to a common theme that we've been talking about today.
Dr. Pearls, how is it that some people, and I know that in some, I don't know if this is the case in your study, that people donate their brains after they've died. Is that the case?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
The study that's probably the best at this is in Europe, the 100-plus study in the Netherlands. They just recently had a paper that I wrote an editorial on in which they had found a substantial number of their centenarians with brains that showed all kinds of markers associated with Alzheimer's disease.
Uh-huh.
And yet when they were alive, they were completely cognitively intact.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah, it speaks to this issue of functional reserve or cognitive reserve and resilience, that despite having pathology in their brains that should translate into the clinical expression of dementia, they don't have it. And they, for some reason that is really unclear, have some kind of resilience, I mean unclear from a biological point of view, that's making up for that pathology. And it's an extremely hot topic in all of gerontology, is the idea of resilience. What can we do to build our resilience? People talk about maybe learning a new language, a new musical instrument, what we call the heavy lifting brain exercises may help with that. Some people think that more years of education are associated with longevity, not just because it's associated with increased socioeconomic status, but maybe there's something going on there in terms of the physical or functional resilience as well.
Dr. Pearls, I mean, when you talk about resilience, though, in the brain with, again, these brains that would show the plaques and tangles that we would think would lead to cognitive deterioration, do you mean that it might be the presence of an enzyme or, again, these clusters of genes, or do you mean something else?
I don't know what I mean yet. This is such this is a brand new area. And as we get more into tools like functional MRI, we're going to start figuring this out. But certainly, whether it's enzymes or other proteins or chemicals that are helping fight some of the processes that are causing cognitive decline, we still have to figure that out.
Okay. Dr. Kawas, do you want to add anything to that? Because this is super interesting.
Right. I think that is, as Tom says, you know, the holy grail right now is we didn't realize how common this was in the very elderly until recently. So, for example, in our study, up to 40% of normal individuals have significant amounts of Alzheimer's disease in their brain when we look at it, and yet remain normal throughout life. And while it's possible that if they'd lived longer, they would have had something, I'm getting more and more impressed that actually this concept of resilience is a meaningful one. When you think about it, for example, in a cancer, you know, there's a lot of stages of the disease, and only near the end stages might you get sick. So a person may have cancer for many years before it makes them get sick. And one of the things we want to figure out is how those individuals who have Alzheimer's disease stayed good so long without getting sick. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the striking things to me is one of the main things we've found so far in most studies is the importance of education. So in the first 25 years of these individuals' lives, the number of years of education that they have is typically associated with their likelihood of having resilience.
Wow.
So brain health, I think probably right from the beginning, is contributing to some of this. But the real question is, what are all the secrets so that we can share them with everybody?
I mean, so this idea of linking education to this, I mean, do you know whether it is, and so that contributes to a life of lifelong learning? You know, what is the real factor about the education?
Wish I knew. What I do know, though, I think with some certainty, is that everybody always wants it to be one thing.
Right.
Vitamin or one thing. And that oversimplifies. I mean, Mother Nature is a lot more complicated than that. So I think it's actually a variety of things that contribute to that. And once we understand, as Tom says, the mechanisms, whether it be education or a gene, then we can go in and try to make it better for everybody, even through medications, potentially.
Okay. Let me grab a call here from Brian in Rush City. Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, good morning. And thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I'm calling because a couple years ago, I was at Mayo to see if I was a candidate for some hand surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And my doctor told me that I was not a good candidate. I'm just getting old. And then she had this lovely discussion with me about what Mayo was doing with something they call Blue Zones.
Yeah.
And they were studying the cultural effect on longevity. She listed a whole bunch of things, but I can't remember all of them. But I do remember two of them. One was if you have lifelong friends, and if you walk to work, and in these diverse places like in Japan and Ukraine, they found that these people had all these same habits.
Yeah,
walking to work, for example, and lifelong friends, and there were a whole bunch of others, but I'm wondering if your guests could comment on that.
Yeah, Dr. Pearls, this is the work that Dan Buettner has done on identifying and studying some of these different areas around the world. I know there's an area in the Mediterranean, I think in Italy. What about the cultural factors that Brian's asking about?
Yeah, and Dan is another Minnesota boy.
He is.
And he started off the study thinking that he's not a scientist, but he does promote really good messages about healthy aging. And I think there's even a community in Minnesota that he got a grant from
yes.
AARP
right.
to infuse that community with all kinds of programs that help promote healthy aging. As far as there being any area in the world that has a high concentration of centenarians, that's very unlikely. But he does look at these communities where there's healthy aging and attempts to come up with some of the commonalities that the caller just spoke to. And it goes back again to this whole issue of environment and genetic interactions.
Dr. Kawas, I have been curious about whether you think the future of pharmacology and aging is going to be to reverse the effects of aging. We heard a little bit about cellular aging earlier. Or do you think it's going to be some kind of intercession at a younger age to, you know, block, I guess, the natural consequences of aging? Do you have a sense of that?
So personally, I very much lean to the latter. I think that, you know, you start aging from the time you're conceived, actually, and the processes that acquire over that long period of our life are really what's important. And in general, in medicine, and especially when we're talking about the nervous system, we're much better at preventing bad things from happening or slowing them down than we are in reversing them or growing new cells or whatever. I also will say that I think at the end of the day, while pharmacology has a whole lot of promise, I think a lot of these lifestyle interventions that we already have accessible to us have at least as much promise, if not more so. I mean, one of some of the things that, for example, the Blue Zone cities that Dan Buettner has been promoting are to do simple things so that it makes it easier for people to walk in areas so that when they go to a restaurant, they'll get offered a salad as the default. They can still change to French fries, but instead of being offered French fries as the default and having to ask for the salad. So the diet we have every day of our lives, the exercise we get every day of our lives, I think it's never too late to start, but I think it definitely is important to start from the beginning of your life.
I am really grateful that you both took an hour out of your research, which is just fascinating research, to join us today. Thank you, Dr. Pearls, Dr. Kawas. Thank you so much. Good to have you on the show.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.